This is Bruce Pabbitt, founder of Sub Pop Records, and you're listening to Whatever, Nevermind.
I've been recording the whole time. We haven't started anything official, so I'll just a welcome to the program. Bruce Pavitt, I got you. You asked how to pronounce my name. Bruce Pavitt is the correct pronunciation, right?
That is the correct pronunciation. Thank you so much.
It'd be awesome if I mispronounced the word Bruce. So
yes.
But yeah, you're the founder of Sub Pop Records, which is the main reason I have you on here. You of course were there for a lot of really key points in the Seattle music scene that changed a lot of things. You know, basically at the start of the 90s. And so, being that I consider you an expert, that's why you are here on the show.
Well, thanks so much. I'll try and pull out some old memories.
All right. Well, that's what we're here for. Let's see how old we can go here. What growing up, what kind of got you into music? Was there a certain band that you gravitated towards, or was there a path you were leaning towards?
Well, I did love listening to radio when I was a kid. I was born in 1959 in the Chicago area. Remember seeing music on the Ed Sullivan Show. One group I bought a lot of singles by was Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Nice.
I remember the first time I saw Nirvana play, he reminded me quite a bit of John Fogerty. I then later learned that he actually formed a Creedence cover band early in the day back in Aberdeen. But I've always been a musical omnivore. I love all kinds of music. And what was exciting about Seattle in the mid-80s is the live shows were off the chain. Green River was incredible, in particular, U-Men, et cetera. A lot of the bands on that list I got to see live, and they were just great. And I was able to see them in a room with 50, 100, 200 people.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes a big difference, I think, especially the fact that you got to see them early.
Absolutely.
Now, when did you move to Seattle then? You mentioned you were kind of from the Midwest to begin with.
Yeah, well, when I was a teen, I was going into Wax Trax Records in Chicago. Got really into punk new wave that was happening in the late 70s. I moved to Olympia in 79, started a radio show at a college there, Evergreen State College. And that was kind of the roots of my fanzine, where I was reviewing a lot of indie underground music from around the country. I moved to Seattle in 1983, and I wound up opening an indie punk record store on Capitol Hill called Fallout. In 1984, I was doing a column called Sub Pop USA in the Rocket. I was DJing local clubs. Bands were crashing on my couch. So, yeah, I'd say it was a ground zero for indie punk alternative scene in Seattle at that time.
Right on. I'm getting ready for this. You know, I had to go back and kind of bone up some old interviews with you and see a couple different discussions on the whole thing. I feel like the fanzine thing kind of gets glossed over quickly into the record label deal. Explain that to me, because it sounds like what you're talking about is you were actually like hand drawing and making like physical copies to distribute.
Yeah, so I was making I was offset printing zines. It started in 1980, and the zines are compiled in a book people could get called Sub Pop USA, but that zine was reviewing records that nobody else was talking about, okay? And what I realized is every city in America had a band, had a scene, had some bands, had records coming out, but you couldn't read about most of these bands. You couldn't find their records. You didn't know where they were. So I was reviewing a lot of very obscure records, especially from Chicago and Seattle, reviewing them and giving them, and then giving addresses so people could order the records. So I was this uber record indie nerd starting in 1980, and I was basically framing the culture as indie rock before that was really a phrase. I was reviewing independent rock. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that covered a wide spectrum of sounds and styles. I was just kind of into everything, but I was always really fascinated with local scenes and what would make local scenes happen, you know, and that's always been my fascination. And then as Seattle really got a vibe going, I was like, damn, this is incredible. I want to just start focusing my attention on Seattle. I've been kind of reviewing what's going on in the States for a while, but Seattle is so hot right now. I'm just going to put all my energy into Seattle.
And we're talking still 1980, or is this a little later? Or
I'm sorry. Again, I moved to Seattle in 84, doing the column. It's still reviewing.
So once you're in Seattle, that's when you kind of shifted. Okay, I got you.
Little bit. The scene really started to coalesce, I think, around 86, 87. Of course, Sub Pop opened its doors in 1988. The first Seattle-based Sub Pop record was Green River Dry as a Bone. That came out in 87. Soundgarden Screaming Life came out in 87. So I was really deep into it. I would say 1987, and then 88 is when Mudhoney and Nirvana started putting out records on Sub Pop. So that's the general chronology there.
So, like, from a distance, and by, I mean, someone who kind of, I was a freshman in college when Nirvana Nevermind came out. So just to give you the time frame of what I'm talking about. From a distance, it seems like the scene was almost like a large hangout. You know, like you guys all kind of coalesced together a lot. It seemed like you brought each other up a lot in conversations, even after some of these bands made it big. Is that an accurate way to describe it? I mean, you're all
yes.
sleeping on each other's couches and bumming cigarettes from each other.
Yeah, I would say that was the beauty of it. It was a small team, small town, small scene. Bands would just go out and support each other. And every week you'd just go out and see another band. I was reviewing records. I had a radio show. I was playing this stuff. So I was kind of a super fan. I was good friends with Mark Arm from Green River, who later morphed into Mudhoney. I was good friends with Charles Peterson, the photographer who documented a lot of it. And it was just a fun, exciting community of people who are very supportive. And that's what made it cool. Now, one of the things we did at Sub Pop, I'll say, is we used a lot of Charles's photos. They were all live. A lot of those photos showed images of, like, let's say Mudhoney playing in a small club. You'd see the band, you'd see the fans. And my feeling was people around the country, if they picked up like a copy of Mudhoney's first album, called Mudhoney, you flip over the back and you see a picture of Mudhoney hanging out, playing live half off the stage, hanging with the crowd there. There was this intimacy and immediacy, and anybody picking up their record just go, damn, these bands are just playing in small clubs. I mean, if I moved to Seattle, I could be one of these people in this photo right here. I could just go to a bar and bump into Mark Arm or Eddie Vedder, and that was true. And that's what made what was going on so exciting for people, is it appeared to be and was accessible and inclusive.
Right on. Where does the Nirvana Love Buzz Big Cheese release come in then? Was that there was a 45 club, I think I may have missed there, that
yes. Well, Nirvana the Love Buzz Big Cheese single came out in late November of 89, and we did a limited edition run of 1,000 copies. They were all hand numbered, and it was actually the beginning of a program that we started at Sub Pop called the Sub Pop Singles Club, where people could subscribe and get limited edition singles. It was the first record, and I remember the day after it came out, my friend Charles Peterson, the photographer, gave me a call and he said, you know, I had a party at my house last night and we threw Love Buzz on and people just kept playing it over and over and over. I thought, all right, that's a good sign. Maybe these guys are going to blow up.
And of course that they did. Was there any talk, like, in the scene, like you talk about everybody kind of mm-hmm. hanging out, was there any, more bigger picture kind of talk, like with some of these bands going, we're going to be huge. We're going to, you know,
yeah, definitely. It was interesting because, you know, I came from like an indie punk background, so I was very anti-major label.
Mm-hmm.
So was Mark Arm. And so there was kind of a split in the scene when Green River broke up, Stone Gossard and Jeff Ament were kind of like, yeah, you know, we want to go in a different direction. We want to get signed from a major. We want to play stadiums. And that to me just seemed weird, you know, just because of my cultural point of view.
Yeah.
So when Green River split up, you had Mudhoney that was kind of truer to the indie culture and the indie spirit. And Jeff and Stone, who I respect a lot, I think they're great people. They just had a different vision, one that I couldn't relate to, but they did go on to a lot of success. So there was kind of a split there for sure.
Kind of an oddball question. This stuck out during my research. Is it true that the original location of Sub Pop was on an 11th floor and the elevator actually stopped at the 10th?
That is correct. yes. Yeah. And I will tell you this, at one point, we were selling so many records that the UPS driver was
going to ask about UPS driver.
He was like, you guys are killing me.
You got to bring it down to the 10th floor.
We had to bring it down to the 10th floor. That's a very acute observation because that actually did happen and was kind of a big deal. So we started lugging things down near the elevator.
I'm not kidding. That was the first thing I thought. I was like, well, you guys are clearly shipping a lot of product. You know, expect the more busier you got even. I mean, they're...
Yeah.
I don't know, taking a two-wheeler.
No, absolutely. In fact, this is a true story. I'll tell you a true anecdote. This is probably, you know, fall of 88. We'd had the office open for about 6 months, and we were selling a lot of stuff. UPS guy literally almost started crying, and I thought, you know, we have... hardly any money in the bank, and I think literally on that day we had like $150 in the bank, seriously. And we're like, we have to go buy a hand truck, and we're like, okay, let's go out and get one. We're heading towards Sears Roebuck down in South Seattle, and we looked out the window, and there was a store that specialized in nothing but hand trucks, and it just seemed like something like out of a David Lynch film. That's all they would sell. We went in there. The hand truck was $125. I bought it, and that was like our first gear investment, was buying a hand truck so we could wheel the shit down.
Nice. And you were better friends with your UPS driver from that point on.
Absolutely.
He put you on his Christmas card list.
That's right.
Speaking of not having a lot of money, the story of Bleach almost not getting financed, I think, is amazing. Do you want to share that? Well, I know it's been told a lot, but...
Well, it is a ridiculous story, you know, when the soon-to-be world's biggest band, which we did not fully realize at the time, they're like, we got to get in the studio. And Kurt calls me up. He says, we got to get in the reciprocal. We're tired of waiting. And I said, I'll be honest with you. We don't have any cash. And I said, do you think you could front the money for the recording? In other words, can you loan me the money so I can give it back to you? And he basically hung up on me. But they did go in the studio, and it was financed by Jason Everman, who didn't actually play on the recording. I think what happened was they went in, the bill was owed, and Jason Everman wound up paying it, even though he wasn't on the recording. But that $608 recording translated into 2 million sales. So kind of it's a profound lesson there as far as understanding that if you create something that's really cool, you don't have to spend a lot of money.
Well, I assume when they went to Geffen, there had to be some kind of buyout with you guys, or were they not under any contract?
There was a very famous contract. They were literally the only band on our label that was signed because they insisted that they get a contract. We Xeroxed one from a book in a library and used a little whiteout, changed a few things around. They signed the contract, and because they signed this contract that they insisted on having, we wound up getting points on a number of different records. and we wound up owning Bleach and so forth. So I don't know. It kind of worked out for everybody.
Definitely worked out. So who else was on the label at the time? Were you dealing with Mudhoney and Soundgarden too? Is this before? I mean, none of those acts had contracts.
Nope. In fact, Soundgarden, we did Screaming Life. They went on to SST and then they went on to A&M. There was no contract, and we went back and forth with management for literally 10 years. So to dial in what the agreement actually was, because at the time it was just a handshake agreement. With Mudhoney, it was a handshake agreement. In the 80s, the classic indie deal was, we'll put out your record. When it starts to make money, we'll split the money with you. And that was just the way things were done. Nobody wanted to spend money on attorneys and contracts because we didn't have the cash. We just wanted to manufacture the records and get them out. But certainly as things evolved, we did start having contracts. But Nirvana was the first one where we actually had a physical contract.
Right on. Well, that was a very serendipitous move, I guess.
It was indeed. And if it wasn't for that contract, I wouldn't be sitting here in my deck staring at these beautiful blue skies here on Orcas Island.
Right on. maybe you can clear something up for me that I was thinking about. When I was doing the Ultra Mega OK episode, my copies on both CD and vinyl are SST, but the reissue from 2017 that Jack Endino remixed and produced, as far as I understand it, is on Sub Pop. How did that? I couldn't find anything that tied that transition. Do you know what happened there?
Frankly, I don't know the details. And as I mentioned before, I kind of exited the company in the late 90s.
Sure.
But the deal makes sense. I know SST kind of fell apart a while ago. And Sub Pop's still around. So I don't know what shenanigans happened at Sub Pop, but it does make sense that they would do a project like that.
No, it was well done, too. I was, that was my least favorite Soundgarden record, largely because of the way it sounded. I can't believe how much better it popped after Jack's
totally.
Work on
good
it.
Good point. Well, Jack's a genius. I love that guy.
he was a really cool dude to talk to, for what it's worth. Well, let me ask you this. Where would you say Sub Pop's peak was, and maybe what do you think their lowest was?
It peaked when I put out my first zine in 1980 and was downhill ever since. it's all a matter of perspective. It's all a matter of perspective, but you know, historically speaking, most people would say the classic early years of late 80s, early 90s. Oh my God, what happened in Seattle? Sub Pop was instrumental in making that happen. Of course, a lot of the bands went on to majors and the whole thing kind of steamrolled, but the label's always going to be associated with that era. However, there have been a number of peaks and valleys. Certainly, you know, in 2004, Sub Pop put out a record by a group called the Postal Service. It sold a million copies, you know. Band of Horses, Fleet Foxes, The Shins. They did a lot of great records. I would say there was a real buzz there from like 2003 to 2008 was kind of a second peak where records are selling 500,000 to a million copies. And now we're in an era where this is a strange time, man. It's a strange time. It's an era of streaming, and the pop charts are just very homogenized. Occasionally something will happen where people go, oh, that's kind of interesting, you know. But when you think back of the early 90s where bam, 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 things were just blowing up out of Seattle, it was a moment that I don't think society has re-experienced since then.
I would agree. I would almost think that there aren't many other comparisons to it in general, and I definitely don't think there's been anything like it since. I mean, the internet has kind of broadened things out, so that's almost its own scene where people can work together from around the world. But
sure,
man, it just And the one thing that as a guy who grew up in Minnesota, went to college here, and all that stuff, it was huge at the time, and the change was very overnight. I mean, within a few months of Teen Spirit breaking, it seemed like suddenly, you know, Pearl Jam is everywhere, and Soundgarden's records, which I believe was out before that, was suddenly picking up steam, and even Alice in Chains, and those big four acts kind of pulled a lot of other bands behind them. So it was very quick.
100%. It was an amazing time. I have just, you know, anecdotes I can throw out. I remember I was in Barcelona, Spain, meeting up with this group called the Super Suckers, who were on tour. And I remember we went out bar hopping in Barcelona in 1994, and every bar we went into was playing music from Seattle. This is in 94, so it was still a very strong international mm-hmm. phenomenon. And to be halfway around the world hearing that, it was a powerful reflection for me, just to see how it impacted global culture.
I think it helped even shit like Starbucks.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I've never heard anybody say that, but yeah, I'll take that.
How about the other angle? Because I personally know people from just my little clique that were like heading to Seattle like it was L.A. in the 80s. You know what I mean?
And totally, man.
And you kind of roll your eyes because it's like, you know, because, you know, they don't have a sudden rebirth. They just are kind of following the cash machine. But when that started happening, it had to just be a flood of just, for lack of a better term, let's just call them posers. I think I'm a little too old to throw that term around is all I mean. But you know what I mean? People who are just kind of like really chasing the money and not really giving a fuck about the scene, if that makes sense.
Well, yes. And also, simultaneously, you had a lot of creative people who were like, fuck it, I'm gonna put on my Doc Martens, pack up my car and go live in Seattle. And it brought in a lot of creative people, and a lot of people are just hungering for a vital community that they could party in, you know. And I think it attracted a lot of interesting people as well as posers. But there were a lot of people just packed up their car and moved to Seattle. We saw that a lot. I remember Ian MacKay from Fugazi stopped by the office and he said, you know, this is like 93, 94. And he said, you know, I was walking down Broadway, and I'll never forget, he said this. He goes, I saw a lot of Doc Martens. And he goes, he said, that's you guys. You guys did that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm just going to take that as a compliment, you know.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I mean, growing up in Minnesota, we had flannel and long underwear, and depending on how, you know, much money you had, ripped jeans were pretty common too. It was totally. The first music scene that I just had to go into my closet to dress cool. So,
oh, absolutely. Well, you know, when I was doing my zine, I have to say that I was zeroing in on Minneapolis and reviewing all the Husker Du records, and certainly the Replacements. Those guys were rocking the flannel before anybody.
Yeah. No, those bands are near and dear to my house. My heart. Sorry, they don't live near me. Well, they might, I guess. but I also kind of like Solo Asylum. They were a little poppier, but they kind of got pulled along once grunge blew up.
Yeah, they're great.
What do you think about the term grunge now? And maybe what did you think about it like 92?
Well, you gotta remember, I'm the guy who wrote the ad copy for the Green River record, right?
So you coined the phrase?
I coined the phrase as far as using it as a marketing term. Certainly, I didn't invent the word grunge, but I used it as ad copy. And when I did, the word grunge was all in caps. And a year later, a British journalist Melody Maker came to Seattle, was blown away by the scene, and he just kind of took that word and ran with it, so it got a lot more international usage. So I'm just, I coined the phrase, dude, so I appreciate the fact that it's still kicking around, and it kind of works. It stuck around for a long time, and I know people in Seattle were like, How dare you unify all these groups? We're all unique individuals. But when people hear the word grunge, they know what it means. It's like there was a vibe, there was fast, you know, Your pants had holes in them. You had a thrift store hat. You had a pawn shop guitar. Your guitar sounded really distorted for the most part. So there's a whole culture that comes into focus immediately when you say it. So it works, and it's going to be around for a long time. I'm sure back in the day, impressionist painters were like, "Don't call me an impressionist. I'm my own style." Like, well, tell that to the museum curator 100 years later, you know.
Like, we're trying to sell tickets here, asshole.
That's right. You're in the impressionist exhibit. Deal with it, you know.
It did get ridiculous where, like, Penny's had their grunge section in their catalogs and fashion show models were doing it.
It got so ridiculous, but it was always kind of an in-joke as well. So the absurdity of that, to me, was just part of the story. I do remember the grunge pencil collection, and I have ads from like Sears Roebuck where you could get your grunge clothes, and I archived that stuff. And it was so ridiculous that you have to embrace it as part of the story.
I am with you.
So I loved it.
I would too.
I loved every second of it. It was nuts. Yeah. It's like the crazier and weirder it got, the more entertained I was. So I'm all about it.
If I was even a bit player in that scene, I would take a little as a badge of honor, especially now. It's like, look at what we did. We were just doing and being ourselves, and now you guys are marketing it. I don't know. It seemed like, for some reason, I remember even McDonald's commercial somehow getting into it. I don't know. The whole thing's just a mess.
Well, there was an AT&T commercial I remember in particular.
Is there any particular mass-marketed version of grunge that you weren't involved in that you liked the best?
Well, I do remember on the David Letterman show, there was a character called Larry Bud Melman, I think was his name.
Right, yeah.
You remember that guy?
Yeah, I do.
So he was on the phone, a pay phone, and he was chatting it up. And then he turned around and he's wearing one of these ski caps and a flannel. And he said something about grunge. And it was just, this commercial was everywhere.
Hey, Slick, you could have spoken for a lot less by dialing 1-800-CONNECT.
Even to Seattle? Thanks, phone dude.
And of course, Letterman was a cult show, and Larry Bud Melman was a cult figure. And so he lent a certain ironic hipster vibe to the AT&T commercial, which was the whole point. And you just had to laugh. Also, Weird Al Yankovic doing the cover of Smells Like Teen Spirit.
What is this song all about? Can't figure any lyrics out. How do the words to it go? I wish you'd tell me.
Was a milestone. I think when that came out, people were like, all right, shit is really blowing up if Weird Al Yankovic is in the mix, you know?
Too bad Coolio didn't have that same opinion about that.
That's right.
He got a little butthurt over that. on the list that I'm breaking down, of course, you know, Sub Pop's all over it. If it's all right, I'd like to ask you, you know, just your thoughts and memories or anything, any anecdotes you want to share about some of these records here. Let's start it off with Mudhoney with their album. Did I get it right? Superfuzz Big Muff, or is it Big Muff Superfuzz? I wrote it down by memory.
It's right on, Superfuzz Big Muff.
Boom.
And I love that record. I think it really holds up. Jack and Dino did an amazing job. Now, it came out back in the vinyl days. Mm-hmm. One of the things we did at Sub Pop that was a little different is a lot of our early records were EPs. So there would be like two songs on one side, three songs on the other. And in that 12-inch EP format, the records sounded a lot better because the grooves were wider.
Sure.
So we were very conscious about doing these EPs, Screaming Life Again, and EP it on. It just sounded better than an album, better than a 7-inch single. So the fidelity was just crushing. And that record just sounded, it was such a, like, represented such a rebirth of rock and roll. It was very raw, but it sounded full. It was somewhat spontaneous. It was on the British charts for a year, the British indie charts for a year, which was unheard of because the British indie charts basically just had British music.
Okay.
So to think that this recording that, you know, I'm sure was less than $1,000, probably like $500 recording, staying on the charts for a year, it was a big deal. And I do think that record really holds up. It's been reissued on CD with, you know, bonus tracks like Touch Me, I'm Sick and so forth. But I think it's really the first extended play that we put out on Sub Pop that kind of blew up internationally and got some international recognition.
So you spent a lot of time talking about the record. How versed are you in vinyl mastering? Because there's a bit of an art there.
There is. I'm not super well versed, but
it was something you guys focused on, though. It sounds like
intended to work with. Oh yeah.
I'm sorry.
We're absolutely. So the beauty of something like Superfuzz was like it was recorded by Jack at Reciprocal. He would record on 2-inch tape, which sounded better. So even though the recordings were pretty cheap and they were just banged out, it was great. And the bands would record live in the studio. So you'd get this live sound, but it would sound full because of the 2-inch tape. Then you'd put it on an EP so the grooves were fat and you make sure the mastering was good. And punk rock, rock and roll, rock, whatever kind of rock you like, it's got to sound full. You know, yeah. It's got to be punchy. Otherwise it sucks.
Another record was Nirvana Bleach. We touched on it a little bit. Outside of the cost of the recording and that stuff, were you involved in anything going on in the studio with them?
I was not, but I will tell you that I was instrumental in sequencing the record.
Ooh.
Kurt had it. Yeah. And Kurt, I think, whined about that a little later because I rejected his sequencing. and this is my philosophy about a label. A good label doesn't give an artist 100% creative control. And typically you hear, oh, corporate labels, they're going to control the artist. Well, to me, the healthiest dynamic is when the artist and the label have a dialogue and figure out the coolest way to do stuff, you know? And I think that's one of the reasons Sub Pop was really happening at that time is because we had an idea of what would work too. And there was kind of a dialogue. So what I'm leading up to is Kurt wanted to bury two of the strongest tracks on the album. And I said, dude, you should open this up with Blue and hit him with About a Girl, like track 3. I've been a record reviewer for years. And I will tell you, if I get an indie record in the mail and I'm going to track 3, track 4, and it's not grabbing me, there's a good chance I'll just toss it to the side and go to the next record. And that's
absolutely
just the way it works, you know? And if you're REM, people are going to listen to the whole thing. But if you're not, you got to like grab them from the beginning. And by 10 minutes into it, you got to knock it out of the park. So I really think that that putting Blue at number 1 and About a Girl at number 5. But I think Kurt retrospectively was like, these guys are telling me what to do. Like, yeah, I actually know what I'm talking about. And you don't, because you're 20 years old and you don't know shit. Okay. So we're going to have this little conversation, as much as I love Kurt. It's like, you want to share your experience with the artist, and that's okay.
100% agree with you, especially for new artists. I mean, I've done my share of record reviews too, and you gotta, people don't know who you are. You gotta grab them quick, otherwise they're not gonna get to your gem at the end of it. But
100%. Yeah. So I was involved with that, and you know, Lisa Orth, the designer, she was like, "What kind of font should we work with?" And she came up with that crazy Nirvana serif font that's now has been basically their logo. And she just busted that out. And one of the things I love about Bleach, again, I was the art director there, so I worked with designers and stuff. We were trying to create a vibe. And I love the fact that you pick up this record, and you're like, okay, these dudes are rockers. Obviously, there's a picture of them rocking out. But who the fuck has this, like, super gay serif font Nirvana? And you flip it over, and there's titles like Floyd the Barber, like Mr. Mustache. What the fuck is this? And this is what we wanted to do. Was like, I hated the fact that, you know, you go to so many genres of rock, and it's just very predictable. Here's the font you use. Here's the look you use. Here's the song titles. And we, even though we had a vibe at Sub Pop, we wanted to fuck with people's preconceptions of what hard rock or underground rock sounded or looked like. And it was just kind of a head scratcher when you picked it up. And these days, everything's streaming, so the visuals aren't as important. But back in the day, the album art was really crucial. Yeah. And I think anybody picking that up would just go, Mr. Mustache, what the fuck is this? I'm gonna check this out.
The world is a much more sarcastic place since 1992.
I would agree.
And that's definitely the grunge ethos.
Yes, I would agree.
What about Green River, Dry as a Bone? We all know what Green River would kind of sort of be, go on to become with him starting Mother Love Bone, and then the situation with Andrew happening, and then starting Pearl Jam. But this was before all that.
It was before all that. You know, they had released an album prior in 1985 on Homestead called Come On Down, which I think is really great. The band just killed it live. They were, to me, like, by 1986, they were the band you would check out live. And Mark Arm was a tremendous frontman, really funny. You never knew what they were going to do. They had all sorts of weird pranks they would pull out on stage. I'm kind of riffing here, but, like, I remember one show they did at the Central Tavern where they pulled an ice chest on stage and it was filled with green jello, and they started throwing it at the crowd. And, you know, in retrospect, that's kind of a ridiculously juvenile thing to do, but you never knew what crazy shit was going to go down at those shows. So I was super stoked about the group. I thought the record came out really well, and
another Jeff EP.
Jeff Ament was really involved with the graphics. I appreciated his eye. Charles Peterson took this amazing photo of Mark on the back, as well as the band on the front. So it was pretty much the launch of Sub Pop as a label focusing on Seattle, and it came out in June of '87. And it was also, just from a Sub Pop biz point of view, it was a moment where myself and John Poneman, who's my business partner, kind of joined forces as he booked the record release party for the record. And it was the first time we really worked together. We then continued to join forces, and he joined up for the Soundgarden record. So it's just a time of coalescence, you know. So to me, yeah, the record really represents a time when a lot of the community came together. Charles Peterson, the band, me, John, and it's, people picked up this record with you know, again, you look at the graphics and you have just the layout and the look of it did not look like anything else that was going on at the time.
Absolutely. You mentioned Jonathan Poneman as your business partner. Is that still, let me just skip to that. Do you have any involvement in Sub Pop any longer at all?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because we've gone in and out of stuff, but literally 2 days ago, John and I did a 3.5-hour interview for NPR, which is going to get whittled down to an hour. And so for the past month or so, we've been talking more, and we, as of a few days ago, good timing, we've decided on doing some collaborations, which I can't really talk about right now, but I'm kind of getting back into what's going on there, but in kind of an indirect way where John and I are just talking and doing some brainstorming.
All right. Well, cool. Well, when can we look for an announcement on what you're talking about?
Well, I would say sometime this year. I've been working on a side project, and I think we're going to try and bring some ideas together. So the headline is Bruce and John are talking, and maybe some crazy shit's going to go down. So
fair enough.
Buckle up.
As I'm talking to you, though, of course, we're all locked into this coronavirus pandemic. It sounds like you have a pretty good setup. You're just riding it out?
Yes. I'm on a remote island surrounded by trees. So I can tell you I'm pretty damn healthy right now.
Nice.
And but it's kind of an interesting situation where I've lived a life of kind of a, you know, I moved here 20 years ago, raised some kids, and I moved out of the city, and I'm living in a rural environment, and there's a lot of, like, social distancing was fashionable here, like, 20 years ago, so I'm ahead of the curve again.
Well, there are a few other bands that you definitely worked with on Sub Pop, but their records aren't in the 25, like Screaming Trees, L7, and Soundgarden. We've talked a little bit on Soundgarden. Is there any memories of any of those, any stories from any of those artists that you'd like to share?
Well, you know, Tad is on that list. I'm a great fan. Well, you know, this is a very surreal part of the whole grunge story, and I don't know if your listeners are aware of this, but a lot of the musicians, I very, very ironically, were working with me at the Muzak Corporation in Seattle.
Okay, that's the elevator music company?
Yes. Mark Arm worked there. Tad Doyle worked there. I worked there. This is true. This is a true anecdote.
Nice. I hadn't heard this.
Yes. And in fact, it was such a weird angle that Spin flew out and wrote a big story about how the fuck did that happen, you know? So we would go in the break room.
Now I know where the Seattle snark comes from.
Yes, absolutely. Just layers of irony and just everything's ridiculous.
Anyway.
But Muzak had, they paid well and had health insurance, and it was a day job. So we're talking 86,
sounds like Canada.
87. Yeah, 86, 87, 88. A lot of these folks were working there. And Tad came in with a demo of a song called Daisy, and he played all the instruments on it. I was blown away. I thought it was really awesome. So one of the very first Sub Pop singles was a Tad single of him playing on all the instruments, and it was so well received. We kind of collaborated and helped bring in some other musicians, and they actually formed a band and, you know, wound up touring with Nirvana and Mudhoney and so forth. So they came out of Muzak. Also, tangentially, I'll say that the first time I heard Touch Me, I'm Sick was when Mark brought it into Muzak. And the first time I heard Nirvana was when John had passed me the infamous demo tape that Jack and Dino had, and Mark and I sat around listening to Nirvana. So a lot of that, a lot of the early seeds of the label and the scene happened in the break room at the Elevator Music Company.
And Mark Arm actually worked at Sub Pop for a bit. Do I have that right?
Yes, he's working there now. He's been for the past, I think, 15 years.
Okay.
He's been managing the warehouse there. So, you know, it's a smart gig. He's got this day gig where he's shipping out records to stores and fans, and then he'll go out on tour and
yeah.
go over to Europe or fly to Tokyo or something. So it's kind of a smart gig.
So if a youngster walked up to you today and said, "What's grunge?" Is there one record you'd give them?
Probably Superfuzz Big Muff.
Okay. And is there a favorite record that you oversaw, let's say, that at Sub Pop?
Wow.
If you want to list a bunch, I don't care.
Well, it's hard to pick favorites. You know, I have two kids, and somebody said, "Hey, which one of your two kids do you like the most?"
You're like, Steve.
I'd be like, no comment. But I will say that for the label, I think this is a historically important record. We put out a compilation record in late 88, like December 88, right before Christmas, called Sub Pop 200. It had 20 bands on it, including Nirvana, Mudhoney, Soundgarden, The Fluid. A lot of these groups that are on that list were all on this compilation. That came out in 1988. And then I will say a month later, it was getting played by John Peel, who was the BBC One radio DJ, who was potentially the most influential tastemaker in the world at that time. He played the record. He did an epic review in the London Observer in which he stated that Sub Pop had the most distinctive regional sound since Tamla Motown, which was a huge endorsement. And that really kind of led to a lot of the British press getting behind us. So I would say the compilation Sub Pop 200, if I had to break it down, you know, to ground zero, that it would probably be that record.
Do you still own any like early first editions of vinyl that you guys pressed?
I do have some, but I'll be honest with you. There was a time when I did sell some of that on eBay because it was very exciting to get paid tons of money for old records that I had kicking around.
It is a good feeling. I got a feeling that you were able to draw in more stuff from my personal collection, but the first time someone gave me $100 for a record I bought for $8 was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's kind of a rush. And then you're just like, fuck it, I'll sell everything. Yeah. You're like, oh my God, I can't believe I just sold that.
The purge begins.
Yeah.
All right. One question I'm asking everybody that I'm talking to someone like you who is part of the scene or a guest on one of the episodes is that, not surprisingly, I think if you look at it objectively, that Nirvana's Nevermind comes in number one on Rolling Stone's list here. Regardless of personal taste, I think we can all accept that if you're looking at it, you know, like I said, objectively, it belongs there.
I agree.
Do you recall, like, let's just put it this way. What were your first thoughts when you heard the record? Did you get to hear it before it came out?
Yes, I did.
Okay,
I did.
So what did you think when you got a chance to hear it?
Okay, I'll tell you. John and I were at the Off-Ramp, one of the small clubs in Seattle, and this is probably a month before the record came out, and the A&R rep from Geffen, her name was Susie Tennant, she came up and she said, I have a cassette of the new Nirvana album. She said, awesome. So we stepped outside. We went into her car and popped it in and listened to the whole thing. And immediately, Poneman and I were looking at each other like, this is going to be so fucking huge. It was like no doubt in our mind. We were right completely on. Blown away. No doubt that it was going to blow up. And then, you know, a month or two later, I'm over at Mark Arm's house and we're watching MTV and Smells Like Teen Spirit is on heavy rotation and we're looking at each other like, can you believe this? And it worked, it made sense, but still it blew up so quickly that even though we knew it was an amazing record, it was almost too good to be true that it was blowing up like that.
And I asked Jack this. I'm curious what you think. How important would you say Dave Grohl as a drummer was to the success of that record?
Absolutely instrumental. Huge difference. I would say Dave Grohl, but also Butch Vig, the producer.
Okay.
It was essentially recorded in Madison at Butch's studio, and then they went to L.A. and did some remixing. And, you know, I'm a little fuzzy on the whole process, but
well, at that point they weren't your band, right? They're on Geffen, but
yeah. But, you know, FYI, we did send Nirvana to Butch Vig to record that album because it was supposed to be on Sub Pop, and they recorded that album with Butch Vig, but then they used that demo or that tape to shop around and get a major label deal. So, you know, The version they came up with the Geffen budget was significantly more awesome, but we did make the Butch Vig intro, and you know, so I do feel that we participated in the creative process. We also introduced the band to the photographer Michael Levine, who did the cover photo and so forth. So we nudged him along there.
how about your legacy? You have to feel good about the role you played in, and frankly, I mean, without trying to overstate it, I mean, in many ways, the whole Seattle grunge scene changed the world, and you're a very instrumental part of that. That has to be something you at least, I don't know, maybe you're not a nostalgic person like myself, but, you know, I would feel pretty happy about that.
Yeah, I'm honored to have participated in that, and, you know, I'll go down to Seattle every once in a while and see Nirvana and Sub Pop t-shirts pretty much every time I go there. And now I'm at the point where, like, I'll just step up to people and start a conversation. Like, I bumped into this one young gentleman who was wearing a Nirvana t-shirt, and I said, "Hey, so you're a Nirvana fan, right?" And he looks at me and he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "They're a band, right?" And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, boy. They're a band." Or I mentioned the other day to somebody, "Yeah, I'm a founder of Sub Pop." And he goes, "Oh, Sub Pop, you mean like the hat?" So at this point in time, the Sub Pop logo and the Nirvana logo are so ubiquitous that people don't even know that it's related to music. It's just out there. So that's kind of a weird fractal where it's become part of the culture, but people, they have no idea what the roots are. So I appreciate shows like yours because it's reminding people that something actually did happen back then. It's more than just a t-shirt.
Exactly. Yeah. Look, there's, you know, when people who care about music are basically, their lives are just one long eye roll when it comes to certain things, you know, it's just like, fuck, you know, you see a reality TV star in a Slayer t-shirt, and they have no idea what they're doing. So
yeah, exactly.
Bruce, thank you so much for your time. You gave me quite a bit of it. I really do appreciate it. This is great stuff. All the best. You know, my sister lives out in Seattle, so I'm going to head out there at some point, but it sounds like beautiful country. I'm just looking forward to get kind of checking out the whole scene there and stuff like that. I've never been, but
pretty damn sweet. You want, be sure to bring your Doc Martens.
I'll have to bust out the credit card to get a pair. That was the one part of the grunge outfit that was like too expensive, you know what I mean? Those were never cheap, you know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, absolutely. I know what you mean, man. But you have a great day. It was fun. Thanks
you
so
too.
Much,
all right, care. Take care.
Bye-bye. Sir, how are you?
I'm well. I'm talking to Bruce.
Yeah, You are indeed, and your name is pronounced, your nickname is pronounced Baco, is that correct?
Baco is the pronunciation, but...
right on.
You can say it however you want it, it's all right.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.